Every lap in under a minute means every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars, unforgettable.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
A Motorsport Podcast Network production. There you are. Here I am, Aaron Noonan here, V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Castrol in 2024, back with you for another week. Thanks for tuning in and spending some time with me, whether you're driving around on your way home from work, to work, however you are consuming this podcast, I wanted to say thank you. Thanks for giving us your ears. We've got another great chat coming up for you on this episode, and a little thank you too to everyone last year that tuned in. Over 370,000 listeners in 2023. This is year number 6 of the V8 Sleuth Podcast, and we are not even close to running out of gas. Another big year coming up, another big ep today, and I thought given this week that we're heading into the race week of the Repco Bathurst 12 Hour, I thought it was pretty timely to go and talk to one of the guys who won the first one back in 1991. Now, Peter Fitzgerald was the king of production car racing over various decades, rule sets, and types of cars. But his win with Alan Greist and Nigel Arkell at Easter in a Supra in 1991 will forever sit in the record books. And on this chat, he reveals the tiny prize, very literally, he got for winning the inaugural race. And he lets us in on a little untold story of how one of his co-drivers was, well, allegedly caught a little busy before his stint. You'll find out what I mean a bit later. Now, Fitz has been battling something pretty nasty, cancer, and he opens up about how he's battling it too. As you'll learn from this podcast, if you don't know him, he is a bit of a stubborn bloke. He's outlived the initial time the doctors gave him when he was diagnosed. He's always up for a chat. He's always good for an opinion. This pod is part one of a two-part chat with a guy that's raced just about everything. This is a real V8 Sleuth special. Enjoy this one. Peter Fitzgerald of the V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Castrol. Our chat recorded on the kitchen table at his place in the east of Melbourne. Fitz, good to see you, mate. It's been a little while. Thanks for taking the time to sit down on the V8 Sleuth Podcast. But we do have a lot to talk about here. There's just your body of work is rather impressive.
Thank you very much, Aaron. Yeah, it's been a while. I mean, I didn't start till late in my life, which was like 27.
Really?
Yeah.
There's kids now who are in Formula One before they're 18.
I know. And I started, you know, because I didn't have what you'd call a rich parent to put me through motorsport. I had to back myself. Mm. And I was working as an accountant at that time. And I had my first Porsche, which was a 2.4S, joined the Porsche Club. And I used to sneak out to Calder in my lunch hours to learn off Frank Gardner. He had the Bob Jane Frank Gardner driving school. So I'd shoot out there at lunchtime and
What was your excuse? What did you tell everyone you were doing?
Well, I was like account manager there. So,
and where were you?
This was Stephen Datner Furriers in Carlton, Fitzroy. And I'd just say, right, I'm ducking out. My hours were my own.
Yeah.
So I'd go out. I'd be about an hour and a half by the time I got out. I'd go out quickly, but I'd come back quietly because I got it out of my system. Yeah, so I did that for about 12 months and because I was running in the Porsche Club and wanted to do better. And a little 2.4S, which was a great car. And I went up to Frank and said, Pete Gagan's car became up for sale in the Lorix Porsche. And I said, look, I'm thinking of buying a race car, but I don't want my ego to run away with my pocketbook. And he just said, well, you listen, you learn, and you're improving, go buy the car.
Simple advice.
That's where it started.
The Frank pops up in your motor racing story a bit later on in the time. We'll get to that with the BMWs and and Bathurst and driving Denny Hulme. But if you started so late, were you interested in cars as a young bloke? Was there exposure to it through the family or friends? Or
always.
Did you go to races as a young bloke?
Yes, mate. My first car was a GT Cortina.
Oh,
1965.
Speedy. Oh, Bathurst special type, right? You know?
Yeah, and I actually went up in that car at Bathurst and got booked in it on the way back. Anyhow, that's another story. And then I had a series of Cooper S XU1s before I came down to Melbourne. And I went to places like Warwick Farm to watch the motorsport.
So where did you grow up?
In Sydney. I'm ex-Sydney, Cronulla Sutherland District.
Yeah.
Shire boy.
Shire boy.
Yeah. Oh,
one of them.
Yeah. So I was doing that in between playing rugby because I played grade rugby in my youth. And then I moved down here. I think I was 21, 1971 or something, and joined Powerhouse in Melbourne and was playing rugby union here at that time. And then gradually, I think when I started racing in 77, I bought the Gagan car for the princely sum of $12,500.
Which at the time...
Wouldn't you like to do it now, mate? Right?
What's that thing worth?
And it blew up in the second race that I had it.
Oh, no.
And Alan Hamilton bailed me out and helped me out, and I think I rebuilt the engine for $3,000. Well, I build engines at the workshop now, mate, and if I could do an engine for $3,000, I'd go hee.
But your customers would too.
Yeah.
So at this point, you are a enthusiast who has got the bug,
yep.
who has got yourself into a position to be able to, all right, I'm going to go and do this. I've had a bit of a taste out at Calder, Belton Round.
Yeah.
How are you funding this? Is this purely coming out of your pocket? Is there friends helping? Is there someone along the way that's got involved here?
Absolutely. I knew I had limited funds, and the first car I bought, which I said was 12 and a half, I think I had $15,000 cash on me.
Mm.
So what I did, I went and saw Bob Jane, had a word to him, and he had a company called, I think it was Maitland Finance or something. Anyhow, he financed 12 and a half grand for me. And I tipped in $2,500, and he funded it. And I used that 12 and a half that I had left to help run it. And my first race was at Hume Weir, which Frank was in his Corvair. And I think it was the last race they had up there.
Mm.
Anyhow, I had the illustrious situation where I spun in front of Frank in a race.
But that was not part of the coaching.
No, and I didn't do any damage, and he didn't abuse me afterwards. So that was my first race, and then the second one was at Sandown where the engine gave way.
Mm. Not a good start.
No.
Slightly auspicious start.
Yeah, so I worked really hard on trying to get sponsors. Grand here, 1500 there. And I just had to be really persistent. I guess if there's anything I've done through my career, it's persist.
Mm.
When the chips are down, you just got to keep knocking on doors, you know.
One will open somewhere.
Somewhere along the line, I figured. And my experience tells me that you can't beat networking.
Mm.
So even if my friend hasn't got the money, he might know someone that does. So I had a number of people in my life that I'll never forget that supported me that way. And that was how I tended to fund the race programs.
It's kind of the motorsport secret sauce. And we get a lot of young drivers who ask us for advice through media or sponsorship and that type of thing. And it's kind of that thing of it's not what you know, it's who you know. And the only way that you get to know anybody of the who's is by going and meeting people and putting yourself in places and opportunities. And it might not be the person that you met yesterday that's the person, but in a month's time, 3 months' time, it's someone they know who's looking for something, who's got an opportunity, they're running a company, they want some exposure, they like cars. Do you know anyone? Oh, yeah, I met that Fitz bloke. Oh, well, talk to him. That's the secret.
Yes.
That's the secret.
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, I even had an interview with Lindsay Fox.
Really?
Yeah, because Lindsay used to come to Datner's to buy his wife some jackets and that. And I looked after him. I mean, seriously, he paid
more
cash.
Than he normally would have.
Yeah, and
else.
I looked after him and I approached him. Anyhow, I remember I even got him, when I spoke to Bob about the fact that I knew Lindsay, he said, son, you get Lindsay in here with me and I'll convince him to sponsor you. I said, oh, okay. So then I worked on Lindsay and I got him in with Bob. And at the end of the discussion, he said, yeah, I'll back you. Come and see me in 2 weeks and we'll sort it all out. And that's where it ended. Because every time I ring to make an appointment to see him, you know, and he, at one stage he said, you tell me you're going to do this and you're going to do that. When you've done it, come back and see me. And I thought, well, I need the money to do
to
it.
To do it.
And
horse, cart,
after
cart,
after winning a championship or whatever, I bumped into him at a Sydney restaurant. And he said, oh, you've been doing all right? I said, yeah, I've won a championship. And he said, oh, that's very good. I said, and I thought to myself, I don't need your money now, even if you offered it to me.
Things change. Things
change. Yeah,
yeah. When did are we still an accountant right through this whole 70s
Absolutely.
Period? We're still crunching numbers at the day job and peddling race cars
but
on weekends.
But then I moved from Datner's and I went into a consultancy role for about 6 months, working as a consultant to a couple of companies because I found a few people that were suffering from cash flow issues. And I went in to try and help those companies. And then I decided I wanted to get more into management because the one thing lacking I found in management was common sense.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
hasn't changed, by the way.
Yeah. Like, why do you go out and buy stock that you're not selling when you've got stock on the shelves?
Mm.
Sell what you got before you go and commit to new purchases that you can't pay for.
Makes sense.
Right? But so many people do it.
Mm.
Anyhow, I joined a company called Seligson and Clare in as an administration manager and looked after their – they sell in the printing industry.
Mm.
And I was with them for probably 7 years. During that period, I went from that job to marketing assistant because I gave them a Bathurst proposition to run a little Gemini with a guy called Ken Price.
I was going to talk to you about that.
Were you?
Yeah. That's on the list.
And I
list.
Said – Ken approached me. It was his car and he'd been running all right in that series. And I said, okay, you look after the car, I'll get the money. So I proposed to the management that they'd back us. And I got us the money. And anyhow, at that time they had a bus that used to go around the countryside with printing presses in it. We demonstrated to the printers. And I said, at Bathurst, there's every year Castrol put out a grid sheet.
Grid card. And you know the funny thing?
Yeah.
We now produce those grid cards.
Do you
cards
do that now?
Business. Yep.
I said, so what I'm suggesting we do, let's take the bus to Bathurst with our latest printing equipment and print the cards for them in the pits.
This is a good plan.
Right?
I like the plan.
And I said, but we've got to still let Bathurst pay the printer that's the local printer they were using. Don't take business off them.
Yep.
So they've still got to pay him, but we'll do it for them for nothing. So basically that was the whole story behind us going to Bathurst, and history will show that the car didn't start because it developed some engine missing practice and Ken couldn't get on top of it. So unfortunately my first attempt failed.
Didn't get to the grid. But did you print the grid cards?
We did.
But you weren't on the grid card?
No. No.
Damn it.
Yeah. But we printed it and, it was a shame. But what happened after that was management said, we want to bring you up and put you in marketing because of the proposal I gave them.
They liked the idea. They liked the thought.
So I ran a few sales promotions and whatever. And then they came to me and said, we've just taken over a new agency from overseas in CompuGraphic photo typesetting equipment. And we'd like you to come on the sales team. And I'm starting to think, accountant, administration, sales team, dollar-wise, am I going backwards? Anyhow, the managing director said, in 2 years' time, you'll come and thank me for this because you're on base salary plus commission. Anyhow, in 12 months, I doubled what I was earning previously.
Not such
doing,
a bad move.
Doing sales, you know. So I've tried to adopt what I learnt in that sales role and marketing into the way I approach my motorsport.
Makes sense.
And you've just got to give value to people, you know. And over the years, all my programs were about not just putting a sign on a car.
It's more.
You've got to do track days. You've got to make them come and feel good. Let them sit in the car. Let them talk about, give them a presentation.
Stuff they don't get elsewhere.
Correct.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And when you look over history, Fitz, at your, you know, when I think of your cars and your race programs, you know, there were sponsors and colours that we instantly identified with you for long periods. There was, you know, it was Goodyear for a period, Falcon for a very long period,
Yokohama,
a great era, Yokohama in the Prodi car days. You had long relationships,
yes,
and clearly it's because of all this stuff.
Yes. Well, see, the interesting thing is Yokohama. When I finished with Yokohama, the marketing manager went to Goodyear.
Oh.
And he said, you're coming with me.
Oh, this all makes sense now.
Right? So I went from Yokies to Goodyear. A guy called Ray Altas was the marketing manager, top bloke. And then later on I was introduced to Falcon and they took me on board as well. And I had them for 7 years.
Yeah, yeah. Long period. Yep. Long period.
Yep.
Every lap in under a minute means every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars, unforgettable.
So I remember so there's a period of Porsches, and I remember by the way, actually, before we get into that, the beard. I dug out some old photos. When did the beard fall away? Were you always a bearded one?
No.
What was the go with the beard?
I don't know. It was probably in the 80s.
Yeah,
when I was at Emery Park and that, running up there. I don't know what brought on the beard, but eventually I started to see grey in the beard. So I said, the beard's got to go. So then the beard went. And, I couldn't even tell you the number of years ago. There's a photo on the wall there in the Commodore. I can't remember. I think that's in the 90s.
It's sort of late 80s, early 90s.
It would have been 90 because they banned the Supra and the RX-7s in 89 when I won the championship in the Supra.
And then they went to the Commodores.
And they went to the Commodores and they wanted Commodore Falcon thing.
Mm.
And I duked it out with Luke Yeldon for that championship. But, probably come off that year, I think.
Mm.
And then
we have photos. We have photos.
Oh, is that right?
We can hold them in the files if you'd like us to. But, we'll see. Hey, that Carrera RSR in the 80s. So that at the time, the Australian GT Championship was kind of really the sports sedan championship under the GT sort of banner. But a great vision of Amaru days and various other racetracks and some
in
of the
various
great
guises too.
Yeah, yeah. You ran that car for a fair while.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Successfully against some of the, you know, the big banger V8s and stuff.
Correct.
Like that. Yeah,
yeah. Because I finished.
Yeah, that helps.
Right.
Not many of them finished every race.
Exactly, and that was my rule. That's always through my career, in sport is to finish anywhere. You've got to finish.
Mm.
And accept second when you got to accept second.
It's actually a tricky one when you try to say it fast.
I'm probably the best second place getter you can know.
They all add up the points.
They do.
All add up.
They do. They do. I mean, probably 84 was my most successful year, and I was running two cars at the same time. I ran the Starion Turbo in the Bob Jane.
The Super Series Group E thing, yeah.
Which I won.
Was that worth good coin back in the day?
Interesting. The first prize at the end was supposed to be worth 20 grand, right? I was 10 grand in cash and an Eliminator boat.
A boat?
A jet boat.
Worth 10 grand as well.
Yeah.
Or maybe not.
I think it was one of the ones you couldn't sell.
Oh.
And
I think it's the deals of motor racing are the best stories I've found on this podcast.
The prize money, though, like it was a great series and it paid right down to 20.
Never a bad thing.
And we had fields of 44 cars.
It was huge. I remember seeing some of the vision, yeah.
And that year sort of really helped and made me, I think, because I started to get offers with Bondi and Mitsubishi Australia and that sort of stuff. Mm. Yeah, it was really great era then. I had a lot of success. I think I won 26 of the 36 races.
Mm. Not a bad year.
Against people like Bondi, Bartlett, Brad Jones, those guys.
Now, speaking of Bradley, so I've chatted with him over the years about things, and he's told the story about his old man waving you down, that they got a sniff of a chance to have a co-drive with you in a proddy race at Oran Park.
Absolutely.
Can we hear the story from your side, where yep. Brad's version is that, like, he's trying to make it in racing. His dad, Phil's got a sniff that there's this race on. It's a pro-am type thing.
At Oran Park.
And we got a – so basically they flag – or he flags you down driving through Albury
yep.
to hit you up to do the deal. Pulled
me over in Wodonga.
Really? Well, in your transporter?
Yeah. So in those days, I was driving a Bedford truck,
yeah,
flat tray, with my Porsche on the back and towing my RX-7.
The Starion.
Starion.
Yeah.
And what he'd done is he'd rung up various garages along the route from North Albury, South Albury, and Wodonga.
And this is before the days of the bypass,
mm-hmm.
where you don't really go into Albury Wodonga anymore.
Yeah.
We do the drive to Bathurst every year. We don't go in
yeah.
unless we need to go for fuel.
Yeah.
In those days, though, you had to go through.
Yeah.
So he had all these spies yeah. set up along the way to
when
tell
when they
him-
said, when you see this truck, give me a ring. And he rushed to Wodonga and flagged me down. And we had a chat, and next minute Brad joined me for Oran Park. And it's history now, we won the event.
The youth of today are going, just call the mobile, just send him a text.
Yeah.
Didn't work in 1984 or whatever it was. So
no.
I love those stories. They're just such good stuff. Why the focus on the proddy cars? So the Porsche stuff is a long timeline for you over here. Right up to now, you're a Porsche man. But the proddy car stuff was where you really made your name. The Starions,
correct.
The RX-7s, the Commodores, Supra. And, of course, all the Porsches, the Supras, a big part of the story too.
Yeah.
Why the focus there? Was that what fit the budget, the style of racing was up
it's
your alley?
It's what I had enough money to
yeah.
do.
Yep.
I didn't have enough money to get into touring cars. And at the time, proddy cars were so popular and getting real good TV. And the plan was always to try and do the best I can, and I was hopefully going to get picked up.
Mm.
And, you know, what hurt me a lot in my career, I think, was the association with KB
mm-hmm.
when he was with Mitsubishi and he was backed by Mitsubishi, and I was beating him.
Mm.
And he quite fancied Brad, and there was a period of time there where when I won the Super Series, Kevin ran in that series. I think the closest he finished to me was third. And I don't know whether it embarrassed him or what it was, but I felt that he did his best to sort of slow down my career. And he was always pushing Brad's campaign. Anyhow, I got offered to drive with Mitsubishi as a second driver, I think, for 85.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, in the same year, I think I did Bathurst with Kevin. I can't remember, it was 84.
Yeah, it was 84.
84, yeah, yeah. And that was when he was preparing his own car.
Yeah, it was just as the Group A class was.
Yeah.
They ran a Group A class at Bathurst before it came in the next year.
Yes.
And you'd driven the Alpha with Bondi in the Sandown 500. But
correct.
He had Elfie Costanzo for Bathurst, and you were with KB and
yeah.
the Starion
so
at Bathurst.
I was more than flattered that Bondi, because he's my hero.
Mm.
He's the guy, like when I do talks at Lions clubs and stuff like that, and I say to people, they say, what's the most exciting time in your history of motorsport? I said, Colin Bond coming to me and asking me to drive with him.
It's pretty cool.
I said, he was my hero for a long time, and he's a top bloke, and that was more than flattering.
Yeah.
You know, because I originally was going to run an Alpha in that series.
Right.
Right, and I'd been talking to Mitsubishi dealership in Nutterwadding, and I was talking to Alfa Romeo Enrico Zanarini.
Who later managed Formula One drivers. Right. And yeah, yeah.
And every bloody time I ring Alfa Romeo, the car got dearer. So in the end, I went with Astarion.
Astarion, didn't
And they lived to rue the day. And they stuck Bondi in to run that series.
Yeah.
And he finished second.
Yeah, yeah. So you won Australian Production Car Championship in the Astarion in 87.
Yep.
The Supra in 89. So the turbo cars really were the cars to have in that sort of period. Yeah. Even there was a turbo Commodore. I think a lot of people forget the VL Commodore. The VL. Turbo was a thing around that time. And they supported the Touring Car Championship in a lot of places. So while a lot of our fans draw back to late 80s and they're thinking Dick Johnson Shell Sierras and Brock in a BMW and, you know, Perkins hanging in there in a Commodore and Nissan Skylines and all sorts of stuff. I love looking back at that Proddy Car era because it was tough fields. Proddy Car Racing's always had a bit of politics connected to it because everyone's trying to get to where they need to get to. Was it as tough and as tight as I sort of feel it was from the outside? Yeah.
It got tougher as it went on, as people, like with Astarion, we were quite dominant. I being a sports person first, I'm not into cheating, okay? So as the guys started to learn about the Astarions and that you could trick them up and cheat them, I concentrated on handling and brakes to get the best out of the Astarion. Others decided they turned the boost up and they had all sorts of little tricks to be able to do that.
Mm.
And I became a little unpopular in the later 80s because I was trying to help the scrutineers to catch the guys that were fudging. And I said, start with my car, you know. And there was a group of Astarions that were running that clearly were quicker in a straight line. But on the handling circuits, I'd whip their ass.
You can say us.
Sorry.
That's not the worst thing we've ever said.
No.
You've got a whole line to get to before we start to bleep or worry about any of that. You're right.
And one of the things is they turn the boost up, and what CAMS eventually did is they banned the use of 100-octane fuel in 1987. And that's when they also announced the first Australian championship for production cars. And it was a two-race event at Winton.
Mm.
And basically it was between Brad and I. And I got pole, Brad got second. And what would happen if you tried running higher boost without 100 octane, it wasn't hard to blow a turbo up. And in the first race, I beat Brad. And then in the second race, he was climbing all over the back of me. And next minute, poof, there's smoke coming out the back of his car. So I'm guessing that maybe he might have just screwed it up a bit.
Who knows? We'll have to ask him one day.
Yeah.
I love that. I think there was a feeling of, because it was, you know, the Supra, the Starion, the turbo cars, and there was a want to get to the Holden and Ford thing in Proddy. So for 1990 in Group A, they swapped it to, you know, the A Falcon and a VEN Commodore,
I think was the thing
at the time, and you're in the Commodore, and again, it was tight, was competitive, it was full on.
Yep.
And
Luke Yeldon was in the Ford. He was front runner.
Kent, Luke's dad. Sorry, yeah, who sadly lost in recent times.
Yeah.
The red 58 Falcon, I remember it vividly. I remember the Goodyear Commodore.
Yeah.
There's Tony Scott, there's Roland Hill, there's Kenny Douglas, there's there's Falcons, Commodores, the little Tiddlers, there's Swifts and Corollas and all sorts of one-off things. We were involved
with Ken Douglas for quite some time, from the RX-7s through the Supras to the Fords. We knew Ken, you know, were associated with him. Because he used to live in Eltham.
Yeah.
He's a top bloke. But when we had the Supra, Ken also ran a Supra. But I had some backing from Toyota at the time. That year in the Ford and Holden, it came down to between Kent and I at Oran Park. And he had protested the suspension modifications on the
production car race with a protest. I've never heard of such a thing.
Yeah, he didn't make himself popular. and we all had to change our suspension. It was an interpretation of the rules, and he got them to agree to his interpretation. And at the event, we had to modify our suspension to new rule changes, which did slow us down. Anyhow, at the beginning of the race, someone put him into the fence.
Was it Commodore?
I'm not sure, but he didn't finish, and I finished on the tail of Scotty, and General Motors were a bit upset. Well, not a bit; they were really upset because if I'd finished in front of him, because I caught him, and I think I qualified poorly and I'd gone through the field and I caught Scotty, and he just held me off and he won the race. I was second. If I'd won it, I would have won the championship.
Holden would have rather to swap around there to win the title. Win the title.
Well, more so to keep peace with General Motors as well. You know?
Yeah. Do you know how to find the right oil for your car? Now you can find out quickly and easily online. Thanks to Castrol's Rego to Oil tool. Simply type in your Rego, select your state, and within seconds you'll know the best Castrol products to unlock the edge of performance in your car. So what's your car best suited to? Just search Rego, the number 2, and oil, and find out. That period, the proddy car stuff's going. So is motor racing your full-time thing by that point, or are you still got a day job? What's the way that's all
working?
Working
I got headhunted by our opposition when I was with Selex and Clare, and I got headhunted by another company in the same arena of typesetting, and I moved to them, AM International. It was, I think, 92.
Okay. So you're well in racing here. The
I was working till 92.
Yeah,
and then I went full time at the age of 42.
So you started racing at what, 27? Did we say?
Yeah.
So was, in the space of 15 years, you've gone from starting pedaling to now this is my thing. I'm all in.
Yeah, because I had good backers like in Falcon who were with me for 7 years. And that enabled me. And I had a lot of other co-sponsors, people that had come on board, you know, like Acer Computers.
Yeah, I remember that. Acer
then influenced one of their big dealers in Melbourne, Leading Solutions. And I think they're closed down now. I think the GFC hit them pretty bad. But they came on board with the same deal and money as Acer did. So they saved my bacon along with Enyo in 2003 when we ran Carrera Cup.
Yeah, I remember.
Because what happened is I lost Falcon because we had to run on Michelin tyres.
Control category, yeah.
So I had to find someone else, and I'd luckily met a lovely bloke called Hans De Corti, and it was his wife's real business, Enyo, based in WA. And he committed some funds to me so I could get going in Carrera Cup.
And they were cleaning products. Because correct. I remember the ads. Enyo.
Yeah.
Enyo. Enyo.
Yep.
Advertising works. It sticks in your head from 20 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
It's unbelievable. I wanted to touch on, so the Supra. So the car that you, was the black car that you won the championship with.
Yokohama.
The Yokohama car. That was the same white car that won the 12-hour, the correct. Very first Bathurst 12-hour. And I want to hone in on that because it's a special part of history because the 12-hour has become such a great event. The GT3 era has really lifted it to the world stage. But in 91, it's kind of a 20-odd car field. It's a bit of a slapdash get-it-going thing with Vince Tesoriero, James Hardy, Channel 10. So is it right that the car that you and Alan Grice and Nigel Arkell from New Zealand won the race in was that proddy car, but by that stage it had kind of become, was it your wife's shopping car at the time?
It was mine.
Yeah, like it had gone back to being a roadie.
I put it back in road trim. I put it back in road trim after 89 because all you could do to them was an exhaust and suspension and brake pads.
Yep.
That's all you could do to them. So it wasn't hard to put them back to stock. Oh, and take the cage out.
Oh, cage, yeah.
Right? So when they brought this race up and they changed the eligibility of cars, this will be a good thing to run.
Mm.
So I changed it
because
back
it was
again.
Out of the regular production car championship. It wasn't permitted, but under the 12-hour, yeah, there was a category for kind of the older, superseded cars.
Yeah,
yeah.
So, and it ran like clockwork. I think it won by 2 laps, and I set the lap record, I think, with about 20 minutes to go. And the guys said, "Well, you slow down." And I said, "Why? The car's through fantastic." You know, and they were worried that I was going to bin it.
Is that one of the most, you won a lot of championships and races and stuff. Does that sit out? That's your, you had a few other Bathurst wins in other races and categories, but does that sit out now as kind of the bannerhead one when you look back on it all?
In a way, when you consider it was the very first 12-hour, when they started running GT3 up there, the first years of doing that, they come back and in the press conferences referred to them, "Here's the guy that won the first one," and I was driving the Audi at the time. It does stand out as a big achievement. But the trophy is probably one of the smallest trophies I've ever had. Honestly, it's up there.
We're in Fitz's lounge room and kitchen, and you've got trophies and bits everywhere here, and he's going to go and show this to me. You can't see this, but we might take a photo of it and put it on our socials when we launch this episode. Seriously, that's the trophy for winning the first. Hang on a second. Hold this up. We're going to take a photo while we're recording of this trophy. And you hold it up here so as we've got the proof. This is what you get for winning the Bathurst 12. Seriously, it's a block of wood with a James Hardy 12-hour kind of thick metal Vagin. Round and sitting on top. Like it's lucky if it's 10 centimetres tall. That's imagine if they rolled that out of the modern 12-hour as the trophy for this GT classic
when you think
race.
Of the money that's in it these days.
Wow. And at the time, I guess no one really knew what it could and would become down the track. So how did you drag Gricey into all that?
I knew Al, because Al had run some production car races with me, like the Winton 300.
Oh, Winton 300, yeah.
Because we won a lot of 300s.
Yeah, that was the race to win, wasn't it?
Yeah,
the Prodigy
really,
car.
At the time.
Yeah.
So, we ran the RX-7 there, we ran the Starion up there. And Alan did one of the events with me, which we didn't win. I think Kenny might have run it, Kenny Douglas, because that was in the RX-7 Turbo 88 car, which the boys had done some preventative maintenance and inadvertently were changing hoses over. And what they didn't realise is one of the hoses that goes to the boost had a pill in it, and they took that hose off, replaced it with a hose, and because it had the pill in it, it would overboost. So it ran a whole flaming race missing with a miss.
Stutter steps.
I think we finished second or third.
Mm.
And so Gricey did that event with me, and I think Kenny might have won it. But we did a few 300s with guys like him, Peter Dane, Tony Longhurst.
Longhurst drove with you, yeah.
He drove with me. We won with Tony.
Yep.
So there's been a good history of some of the drivers. Alan Jones, I was a stand-in for Tony.
I remember that. It's on my list. Okay. It's on my list.
I don't want to jump
you. No, that's right. And probably of all the Bathurst 12-hour winners over the journey, the Mazda years, then the Prodigy car race came back, and now the GT3 and some of the great Aussie drivers and overseas drivers who've won it, but the third driver that year is probably the most unknown 12-hour winner in the history of the event in Nigel Arkell. I don't know anything about him other than he's a Kiwi. Yeah. How did he get into this mix?
Yeah, I got a phone call from his dad out of New Zealand. How he decided to ring me, I don't know, but he asked would I put him in the car, and he sold me a bill of goods, including some money. And that always speaks, as you know.
Bit of budget never hurts. Yeah.
So he paid for his ride and came along, and that was a rather funny drive. He was a young, good-looking, strapping bloke, and he wasn't as quick as Gricey and I, I don't know whether I should say this, but we sent the guys out at one stage to get him to do his stint in the car, and they went back to the truck to say, "Can you come on out?" He was getting trains to come. And he was otherwise engaged with a young grid girl. And we won't go
into
more
detail. He was having a conversation with a local
grid girl.
Okay.
That kept him busy. And we said, sorry to interrupt you, but you've got to drive in a minute.
I'm sure he's not the first, and I'm sure he's not the last.
Oh, dear.
What happened to the Supra that won the very first Bathurst 12-hour? Do we know?
It got sold off as a road car.
Right.
Well, I turned it back to a road car.
Yeah.
And then I flogged it. I couldn't even tell you. It's that far back.
So there could be someone driving around in that somewhere now who has no
idea
the piece of Australian motorsport history that they're driving.
Yeah.
We've got to find it.
Yeah.
We've got to
It'd
do
be
some
nice
sleuthing.
To know, wouldn't it?
We might have to swap our V8 sleuth cap for our Supra sleuth cap. It might be a plan that we do.
Yeah.
That 91 year was, I reckon, in your career, very cool because you got the 12-hour win, which is, as time's gone on, that's probably become more special as the history of that race has grown. I went to the Sandown 500 as a kid every year from Ballarat from the mid-'80s onwards in 1991. This will blow the youngsters' brains these days. So at the Sandown 500 that year, you were in pretty much every race on the bill on the Sunday that I saw because you were co-driving the BM with Alan Jones, filling in for Tony Longhurst,
correct,
who was crook. You had your Commodore Proddy car and you're in the Porsche Cup race.
Uh-huh.
People don't do that stuff these days.
No.
It's kind of they've got to put all their focus into the one thing, but you've ended up with all of these things on the same day, finishing second in the 500. I mean, it's nuts looking back on it. Like, how did you do all this stuff?
I'm just crazy, you know, crazy enthusiastic, you know. Like, you think of me now and what I'm going through with my health issues and I'm going to Witten on Saturday and I'm going to run a lap dash if I can get round for. I said, I've only got, everyone's telling me not to do it.
Yeah.
I said, I've only got to do one quick lap.
It's only 3Ks.
You know? So if I get that time in, I'll park it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's just me. It's something's got to get you up in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's my love, my passion.
Yeah. Let's talk about that because we're sort of driven into that topic a little bit where we sort of dart around in these chats. We try to keep it chronological, but we veer off here and there when things arise. So for those who don't know, cancer's been a thing that's been at you for, 5 or 6 years now?
6 years.
Yeah. So what is it? Where are you at? How's it all travelling?
I was diagnosed February 18.
Hmm.
I've never had any hint of having an issue. And I woke up one morning and I was crook. And I went to the doctors, told him what happened. He said, get down, get scanned. We got to operate. You've got a blockage. They operated, said, you've got stage 4 bowel cancer.
And not a hint.
Not a hint.
Just one day, bang.
And they took 90% of my large bowel.
Wow.
And said, you've got 2 years.
Their maths were no good then.
Hmm?
Their maths are no good. Last time I checked, we're in 24, mate.
Yeah, but I told you I'm stubborn.
You are.
And I've got a really good oncologist who's been in a good medical team that have been looking after me. And I had to go to chemo on a regular basis after that. And fortunately, I go to the Epworth in Box Hill, which is was close to our workshop.
I was going to say close to the workshop at least. Yeah.
So I would walk down, I'd do the 4 hours of chemo, then I'd walk back to work regularly. And I was, because they said, try and stay fit, you know. So I tried to do all that. And we've sort of stalled it off with various operations. Had one on my lung to remove a bit because it metastasized. And then that was the end of 19, I think, or 18. And then I went through more chemo. Then I've had radiation. And then, unfortunately, in 23, they said, look, we're going to have to go in and take the bladder and rest of the bowel and you'll be on bags.
Mm.
And last year's been the worst year. I've had to put up with all the complications that go with that sort of stuff. And it's been very unpleasant. And I was glad to see the end of 23.
Mm.
And now I'm back on radiation again as of a week ago. And I finished that hopefully Thursday when they'll decide if they extend it another 5 days.
And we're having this chat in just to put the context, because this episode will come live a little bit later than when we're having the chat. So we're sitting here at the very end of January to put the time frame in for people who are tuning in to listen to this, whether they listen to the podcast maybe a bit later in the year or get it sometime down the track. So, but for all of that, and 23 being probably the worst year from a health perspective, I see there's a trophy here from the Porsche Club Victoria. Yeah. How did you find the time to slip in a trophy win in 23?
Well, they tend to have one event a month, and we do support for the Porsche Club. So we go along, we'll take some mechanics out, and Marina and I will go out and we'll cook them all, put on a table with an espresso, coffee, tea, fresh fruit and bakery items during the day, and I'll mentor the customers, and so will Christian, my son. And we'll put on a barbecue lunch. So they're all looked after. We've got mechanics there to do their tyre pressures, sway bar changes, wings.
Everything they need. They just can turn up and look come after and enjoy. Yep.
And we'll have anywhere between 10 and 20 clients on a day that we look after, you know. So, and I run a car because I want to promote what we do. And we've had quite a bit of success with the new 718 Boxster Caymans, which are a 2.5 turbo, and we tuned a little 2-litre Cayman for a guy, and they do 4.9 seconds, 0 to 100.
Jeez.
Right? But when we finished with it, it did 3.6.
I was waiting for a reduction in that time.
And I thought, geez, that's just a 2-litre. What if we got it 2.5? Yes. Well, you are restricted by grip when you do them up, and I didn't really beat the 3.5. 3.5 I got out of the S Boxster that I ran, but that little S Boxster is competitive with 991 GT3s.
Wow.
And it has 5 lap records in the club.
Jeez.
And we went to a Cayman and we started to develop that, which we sold 2 weeks ago. And unfortunately, because I sold FRS to one of our partners in Evolve last year, so I've just got interest in twin turbo or Evolve Technique now, which my son helps me run, and he also is running FRS. Mm-hmm. Alex wanted to sell the Cayman because the move from Box Hill to Burwood was capital intensive with costs and much bigger premises, much bigger rent, which is because Alex is EMA Manthi.
Yes.
So that's in our shop. Yep. All those GT3 cars and the cup cars are in our shop. So I was really didn't have a car to drive in the club stuff anymore. And one of our other customers that we tuned his Boxster, a little red 718S, he decided he wanted to sell and buy a McLaren. And I've ended up buying that off him personally, and I'm running that. So I've done 2 events in that, and it was developed not to the stage of the first one, and I'm gradually changing.
I was going to say it's not going to be like that for long.
Yeah, I'm about half a second away from the first one. So I plan on.
Oh, you're unbelievable! You're a shocker! You're a shocker! I love it! I love it! It's great, mate. The I can only presume. We talked briefly a bit about the BMW stuff before and the B&H stuff.
Yep.
Was that the link to Frank from back in the day that got you the drive there, or how did that all play out?
The first time happened back in, I think I had a conversation with him over in Malala when there was some rule that came out about the James Hardy that required the use of production car drivers.
Oh, there was a sniff that they won't be introducing production cars to the race there at one point to try to beef it up.
And I had a word with, why don't you just grab some of the good drivers out of Prodcars and put them in your BMW? And they obviously thought about it because then they offered me the run at a cost, I might add, but it wasn't much. It was like $5,000, and he was going to give me a Guernsey in with Denny Holm.
Formula One world champion of 67, I reckon I could make that happen.
I can make that happen.
Yeah.
So what happened was I agreed to that, and I was to do Bathurst. And I went up for a test day at Lakeside, and I spent the day there with them getting acclimatised with the car. And then on the Sunday, I was invited out on their boats. So there was Dick Johnson's boat, Gricey's boat, Longhurst's boat, and that was the time when Longhurst and Gricey were not talking.
Oh, yeah, they had
over the Alfa Romeo.
The
Alfa
thing from in the 80s, right? Yeah.
So you had the boats moored out at...
Was Dick in the middle between them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So they were moored out at whatever beach, what island it was off the coast, just close, the close, can't remember the name of it. But they were moored out there for the day. And you had Gricey on one boat and the other side and Longhurst on the other.
You'd driven with both of them, yeah. And you were both, so you caught him in the... Oh, geez. Yeah. Oh, geez.
And you know what surprised me that day? Dick and the guys, you know, were on the beach cleaning the beach.
Clean up Australia Day.
Well, I don't know, mate, but I was impressed that they made the effort to go around and pick up rubbish that other people had dumped there.
Mm.
It surprised me that they would do that, you know.
Mm.
So that was impressive. It's a bit of an aside, I know.
That's what we do on this podcast, mate. We are the Tangent Kings.
Yeah. So what happened then, I think it was the next week they were supposed to do the 500. And I got a phone call on the Monday saying, hey, Tony's got food poisoning. Can you stand in for him with Alan?
Well, you're going to be there anyway because you're correct. Doing the Porsche and the Prodi car.
Yeah. Yeah. So I said, yeah, sure, I'm in for that. And but as it turned out, Alan those days was doing the telecasts for Formula One.
Channel 9.
Channel
yeah.
9. So normally I would have started, he would have finished. But it turned out he started and I was to finish.
Because he had to leg it to Sydney to do the correct. Formula One coverage.
Correct. And the bugger, in his first stint, he had a bit of an off on a curb and disconnected the rear sway bar. It was knocked off so it wasn't doing its job. So the thing was an understeering pig. And he came in, he pitted a little bit earlier than he was expected. He said, there you go, Fitzy, it's all yours.
And hightailed it.
I struggled around for the rest of the race. History, we finished second. But I ended up with blisters after it. but, yeah, it was interesting. And I loved it, driving with him. He's a good bloke. And then we went to Bathurst with Denny. And they didn't finish. They had a mechanical failure. And Denny and I won the class and finished fourth.
Yeah, I've got the photos. You're yep. up there on the podium in the day where
yeah.
top three outright got the podium, but then the class winners got their
yeah.
their chance to be up there at the podium as
and
well.
And Denny was in his 50s, I think, then.
Yeah.
54 yeah. or 5. He was a top bloke.
Yeah.
And it was the next year that he passed away.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the next year I didn't get a Guernsey because they hired the Europeans like Rivalia.
Oh, they had Johnny Giacotto. Johnny Giacotto was there the next year. Yeah. yeah. And Paul Morris was obviously yeah. on the scene by that
and
stage
And I'd been
too.
Up on the Saturday with Porsche Cup and sprinted back to Melbourne to watch the race on the Sunday. And I remember watching it with my wife. And when Denny went off, he veered to the left into the wall and down. I said, I don't like the look of this.
Didn't look right,
No, because he'd had a heart attack in the car, you know.
Mm.
Bloody shame.
Yeah, yeah.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, The Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
The next little era. I mean, you'd been a Porsche bloke right the way through there from your early time going out to Calder and
yeah.
banging around in your lunchtime.
Yeah.
But then we got the 968 Club Sport. So the Prodi car, when this real Porsche Mazda thing really did light up. So that second year of the 12-hour really boomed. Mazda came in with the RX-7 and wiped the floor. But for 93, Porsche came on the scene with you and the 968 Club Sport, couple of cars, bunch of well-credentialed drivers. Wasn't the Falcon cars initially? They were the Hardy Ducks and the white and red cars.
Yep, Ducks, Agfa or whatever.
Yeah, that's it. Brett Peters was that's in there. Right. Johnny
Morgan,
Smith,
Jeff Morgan.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember them all now.
Yeah, there's a few. There was Kevin Waldock was tied in with something.
Smithy.
Johnny Smith was in there.
Johnny Smith.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There was
Kevin Waldock, yes.
Waldock was in there. So there was a Sandown 6 hour, and you guys won that to begin 93. That was the debut of the
Now, there's a story, yes.
I like stories. Do tell stories.
Yeah, so I originally approached Porsche to run a 964 911 in the 12-hour. And the then new CEO, Nicholas Leutwiler, we used to call him Rottweiler. He was a bit of a demon. But I approached them and they wanted us to get into the 6.8. They said, we're bringing out a club sport version, which was about 50 kilo lighter, had an LSD, and that was really only the difference. And he said, that's going to be here. So I agreed to do that. He said, but the only problem is it won't be here till January.
Ooh, that doesn't allow much time to get ready, does it?
Not when you've got roll cages to build and suspension to sort out. Because, again, the Freedoms were very brake pads. You could put a you had to have a roll cage, seats, and exhaust. So I said, can you give me a mule car? In other words, a normal 968, which they had. So they supplied me with one of those, and we prefabricated the roll cage. We put one in that car. We then did suspension mods and we did testing and all that and got the exhaust, gave us about another 10 kilowatts. And so that when the cars arrived, we had stuff ready to bolt straight in because we only had like 2 or 3 weeks. And that's what we went to Sandown with. And then I used to drill the blokes on pit stops at our workshop before we get there. And we try different stuff and try and get it right. And the Mazdas were quicker at Sandown. But where we beat them was in the pits with brake changes and whatever. Anyhow, in those days, you were only allowed 4 guys on in a pit stop to work on the car. But what I didn't know at the time was Tesserero was a bit of a puppet for Mazda. So when we got the Bathurst, the rules...
Here we go, the Mazda Porsche thing. It's up again, it's up again.
The rules had changed where you could have up to 8 guys on the pit stop. So they improved their brake changes. And we ran first 1 and 2 at Sandown, but when we got there, we ran 2nd and 3rd and then got excluded.
Yeah, what was that for again?
My front wheel offset was 5 millimetres out from spec the wrong way.
Which wouldn't have helped.
Which wasn't an advantage, right? And I was called up at the end of the race to answer the protest, and I said, I'm not even aware of this. And I said, we were given specs on the wheels from Porsche, which we had Simmons make up our sets, and we
didn't think of it again.
We didn't think of it again.
Yeah.
Anyhow, first only time in my history I was suspended, and I appealed it. And by the time I got to the appeal, I ended up 4 months. I couldn't drive. But it turned out that after Porsche had advised me of the specs, they changed them and they hadn't advised me of the change. Needless to say, it was not an advantage, but it cost me 4 months. And the whole thing never came up again. And we ran them the next year.
Nothing happened.
So that's when I brought Jimmy on board and we're with Falcon cars.
I was going to say the next year they were the Falcon cars. Jimmy was involved. I think Brad was in the second car.
Yeah.
Nicholas Leutwiler was in your driving lineup too. I think he was in your car, wasn't he, from memory? But but that became your Bathurst, didn't
Correct.
It? The 12-hour there. The,
yeah.
The 1000, you did do some racing. We'll cover off the great race stuff. But that became your Bathurst. That was your great race every year.
Yeah, because we had success in the 6.8s, forgetting about the protest. And also then I got approached to run after this. In between, I ran a Commodore.
Oh, there was the Group A Goodyear car,
the
V8.
Yeah, swimming pool rear deck.
Yeah, yes. And that was the year of the Ute.
Yeah. That's, we built that for Gricey and Brad.
Yeah, the Akubra Ute.
That was quite a quick Ute.
Yeah.
You know, it surprised a lot of people.
People remember it vividly.
And both cars were quick. Both cars could have, well, probably our Group A we could have won. And I think Brett was still with us then.
He was, yeah.
But you know what killed us? We had to put FT3 fuel tanks in it and they delaminated in the race and they were clogging up the fuel filters.
Yeah.
And we end up with engine misses and all sorts of stuff.
More stuttering.
And that's what killed our race.
Mm. Bathurst. Bloody Bathurst. Bloody Bathurst.
Heartbreak.
So 93, we get flung. Mazda win. 94, Mazda win again.
And we're second.
You guys are second.
Second and third.
12-hour disappears from Bathurst.
Yeah.
It goes Eastern Creek the next year.
That's right. And we had the debut of the 993.
RSCS, which they're worth a pretty penny now, aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
They'd like be a very handy grand thing to have tucked away. And they weren't 700 grand to buy.
No, 200, 225.
Geez, do you know where that one ended up?
Yeah, I do. A guy called Matt Humphreys in Sydney.
Uh-huh.
He's got it because he's on my Facebook.
Right. Facebook brings people together.
Yeah.
Brings people together.
So that car, I got pole. I did two laps. Bing.
Mm.
Got pole in that.
At Eastern Creek. Yeah.
And I was driving with Jim.
Mm.
And we had Yokohama backing, and they were there. They came out for that race. But we had trouble with their tyres, and we knew if it got hot, we were going to have issues. And we had to watch what pressures we ran and had to look after them and all that. And Bowie was driving for Mazda.
With Dick in the RX-7 Triple M car.
That's right. And during the race, we were running at the front, and there'd been an incident that brought out the pace car. And unfortunately, the pace car cocked up and picked up the wrong leader.
Because that's never happened before. That's a common thing.
And it gave Mazda another lap.
Oh, I remember there was a blue battle. It was a bitter one.
Porsche wanted me to pull out of the event.
Mid-event?
Yep.
Mid-race?
Mid-race. They wanted me to pull out. They said, this is bullshit. Shouldn't occur. But the Japanese would have lost face if we did that. And I said, we've got to keep going.
So you were Falcon at that stage, weren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So and it's kind of like, well, you got to press on.
Yeah. So we got to press on. And it's history. We ran second. But I was trying to run down John at the end, and I ended up metal to metal on the front brakes.
So it's that period.
And that
period
was the last 12-hour.
That was the last 12-hour because it only was at Eastern Creek just the once.
Yeah.
And then it was gone until I think it came back in 07 as a proddy car race, and that's another chapter of its history. But in that 94 year, that's when FRS, Fitzgerald Racing Services, was set up, wasn't it? That's when
93, 94,
that 968 sort of period there.
Yeah.
So was it, do I remember right, I remember Bob Hiscock, who worked with you for a long time, ran your cars.
38 years.
38? Jeez, that's a long service, isn't it?
I miss him like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah. So he had prepped your cars though beforehand and then came to work for you at FRS.
He was the reason I was successful.
Yeah.
Because his preparation was meticulous. His control in the pits, like we've always had, as you can see, we've talked about long distance races. We've had excellent results.
Mm.
Our 4 days being long distance, got to be there at the end. And his pit strategies and all the calls he's made were right. And we'd often discuss over radio, you know, what we should do. But yeah, he's fantastic. And unfortunately, Bobby, I forget how many years ago now, but say over 5 years ago, he finished up with us because he first of all got Bell's palsy. That only lasted about 8 months. Then he had two hip replacements and he got Parkinson's.
Yeah.
And then when I was in hospital in 2018, I rang him up to have a chat and his wife said, oh, Bob's just got out of hospital for prostate.
Oh.
So they've moved down to Geelong now, and I touched base with them about 3 weeks ago, actually.
Mm.
We're going to try and catch up.
Oh, good. I remember him vividly from the Porsche racing when I was around the Carrera Cup.
Don't make them like
that. Nations Cup. Yeah, no, he was right there with you with all of that stuff.
Yeah.
How did the Falcon deal come together? Because if I did Peter Fitzgerald word association with our listeners, or if I did Falcon with anyone in Australian racing, it's you pretty much.
Yeah.
Like they've done the odd other thing along the way. There was a GDR and a Maserati 12-hour car. But how did Falcon come to be?
Okay, so a good friend of mine was a guy called Mike Abbey, who owned the Mag Wheel Centre. And I spoke before about networking.
Mm.
And he knew Spencer Grimmer, who was Hallmark Trailers in Queensland, they were the Australian distributor of Falcon Tyres, Otsu. And he arranged to get me an appointment with Spencer, who came to my home in Warrandyte one day, and we chatted, did the deal.
Bang.
Came on board on the spot.
That's good.
Yeah, and it was a considerable amount of money in those days. And he just stuck with me all through, you know, and they took me to Japan twice. They took the car to Japan once, put it on display at the Osaka automotive show. And I learned one thing, why the Japanese made car TVs. Because on the way to the show, they on what happened was the second day I appeared on the stand on the Saturday, and the second day they were going to take me sightseeing. Anyhow, after the first day's success, they said, would you mind coming back for the Sunday because we had a good signature.
Good reaction,
good reaction. I said, sure, and that's what I'm here for. I'm here because give you back support you've given me.
Yeah.
And then I realised on the way to the show, there was a queue of cars miles long. We end up getting out and walking to the show. But they've all got televisions and they're watching watch their television while they're waiting in the traffic. So I figured that's why in Japan they made them.
They had time to use them.
Yeah, exactly.
They had time to use them.
But they were lined up like in the booth I was on, and I'm thinking, who am I? You know, I'm just
some Aussie guy. Driver. Yeah, who is this guy?
All these Japanese guys and fans lined up down the road to get a signature.
But Falcon has such a history in Japanese racing that if you're connected to them, then hey, you must be a big deal.
Yeah.
Fitzy-san, very good.
Fitzy-san.
It's very good. Very good. That's where my chat with Peter Fitzgerald on the V8 Salute podcast, powered by Castrol, is just going to come to a little pause. We covered a truckload there, didn't we? And the great thing is we've got another truckload to come next week. There were some stories I hadn't heard about, and there's been a few that I've actually been meaning to ask him over the years, so I'm glad that I got the chance to do that. Now, before we get to part two next time, tune in for the Motorsport News podcast every Tuesday, and new in 2024, you can also catch the BJR Rundown from deep inside Brad Jones Racing in Albury, taking you inside one of the teams in the Repco Supercars Championship. There's regular episodes dropping right throughout the year here on our Motorsport Podcast Network. That's us done for this ep of the V8 Salute Podcast. I'm Aaron Noonan. As always, thanks for tuning in and spending some time with me. Send us your feedback via the form on our V8 Salute website, and I'll chat to you next time. Bye for now.
Every lap in under a minute means every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars, unforgettable.